pleasure to be here tonight. And as a hominy boy, I always looked up at Bartlesville as this very vibrant, elite, from my perspective, community. And you've lived up to that grandly all these years. It's a remarkable community. And I don't just limit it to Washington County, but also the other five counties that you serve. Strong council, and I'm very honored to be here tonight. As I survey the room, you know, so many of you I know in many different walks of life. I visited with Carol Whitebrook, who was your former council executive, and I was her first volunteer supervisor when she was a young professional in Tulsa, and she's gone on to great things. And her husband Merle was my mentor in Friends of Scouting, and he and I together have shaken down a lot of people, so I'm sure you're going to shake down. If you're here tonight, you're here to support Scouting in some form or fashion. A lot of you are guests, you're invited. This is an exposure maybe for the very first time or the first time in 20 years to Scouting. The rest of you are volunteers, youth, your leaders, you care about your community. I want to spend just a few minutes with you to just give you kind of like maybe if St. Paul were speaking tonight, he would just kind of say, this is just how it is, how his life was. I'm going to give you just a snippet of life in Scouting from my perspective. Grew up 7 miles east of Hominy. My nearest neighbor was about 4.5 miles away. True Hayseed from Hominy, right here at the podium with you. And the one get-out-of-jail-free activity, you know, so we were expected to go to school and do well, be at church anytime the door was open, but Scouting was the other alternative. And being the fifth generation Drummond rancher in Osage County, where any of you guys who know Drummonds, you know, I would never marry one. I wouldn't hang out with any if I had a choice. We're kind of a tough, rascally group. And so my brothers and I, we fled to Boy Scouts anytime there was an opportunity. So, I mean, if there was something in Scouting, we did it. And as was some of my curriculum background indicated, I mean, I was a busy boy. I wanted to be off the ranch. It was a free pass, and it was great. That experience in Scouting literally took this very quiet, introverted boy who I just wouldn't expose to anything out on the ranch. I mean, I didn't have a friend one. My friends were my brothers and the men on the ranch that would protect me from my father until I went to school. And I mean, so I did not, I mean, I was, so I look back, and the reason that I have accomplished what little few things I've accomplished in this world, I give 100% of the credit, 100% of the credit to the exposure I got through Boy Scouting. So young men and women back there in uniform, through Scouting, you'll learn to present, speak, have confidence, do your very best. You'll learn skills that will serve you the rest of your life. I didn't appreciate that growing up in Hominy. When I accepted a commission in the Air Force, in anticipation of that, I thought, you know, I need to continue to do things legitimate and run away from the ranch. And I didn't really want to go back after Oklahoma State and go be an assistant to my father. I would be an absolute bona fide alcoholic today. So I thought, well, what can I do? And I thought, well, you know, I can go to the military. That's a logical alternative. So as I signed up with the Army and then tested, the Air Force got my scores, and they said, oh, son, you know, you need to come be a pilot. I'd never even flown, never thought about it. That would have, you know, it sounds kind of romantic. Little did I know Tom Cruise was following me around and would ultimately do Top Gun. But so I went to flight school, and all these engineers, and I know we're in Bartlesville, so there's a lot of engineers, and I respect you guys tremendously. But in an aircraft, you can try to outthink that jet, right? And these engineers I was going to flight school with were always thinking, how does the engine work? It was a horse. If I want to go faster, I kick it. But there, you just move the left hand forward. If you want to slow down, or, you know, you use your right hand, that was up and down. And it was really that. And I always was taught as a young man to listen to the horse. The horse talks to you through your bottom. So that's exactly how I applied aviation. I just listened to my butt. And if it started buffeting, I knew I'm going too slow. I'd lower my nose or add power. If, you know, paint was peeling back, I knew it was going too fast, slow down. So It was simple, and oddly, I went to a NATO training base, so all my instructors were European. Europeans are not engineers. I think they just recruit them from Asia. They don't have any over there. So all these European aviators all flew by the seat of their pants, and they loved me. And I was not a good pilot, but they loved me. Therefore, when somebody had to get, you know, the top of the class, they gave it to me because they loved me. Plus, Gender, I mean, it's pretty German, so I feel right here. So I get this F-15, and literally, I've gone to flight school I have not flown before. So I'm assigned an F-15, and they go, well, you know, you single-seat fighter pilots have to go do water survival and land survival and all this stuff and all that. Yeah, great. I show up, and it's they put all the pilots through together, so there was 100 pilots. And you do a lot of survival training, and I actually gained weight because I've been Boy Scout, I could eat anything. But the last 7 days of this was search and evasion and POW training. And so for safety reasons, they paired us up. So everybody randomly got paired up. My partner was an Eagle Scout from Alabama. Grew up on a farm. I thought, oh, this is going to be good. So, you know, they gave us a map. They gave us a strip of parachute. They gave you a knife and some string and a bottle of water. And you had 20 miles to travel to the recovery area. And they had guards out there to catch you. And if they caught you, they immediately put you in the prisoner of war camp. And if you made it to the end, which nobody had, you know, then they put you in the prisoner of war camp. So you end up in the prisoner of war camp regardless. But we had 3 days to do that. So everybody, you know, ready to go, and everybody's, you know, running off. And I mean, you know, the guys from New York were immediately caught, like 20 yards down. The guys from California, they just rolled over, put their arms up. They were caught, you know. So the Alabama, if any of you guys from there, I'm sorry. But the Alabama guy and I said, you know, we have 3 days, 20 miles. Not a big deal. We've both been to Philmont. We can do that easy in a day. So instead of going forward, we went sideways. And we went sideways until we knew we were off the map. And then we came back in and raided the guards' food supplies and water supplies. One guard was asleep. We tied him up, put him in the middle of the road. I mean, we just had a blast. Never got caught. And then we went all the way around the recovery area. And we came in, you know, 5 minutes before the time was up because we'd just been out napping. And we were the only two people that made it in. Of course, they just were totally frustrated, knew who we were, had seen our tracks, got the guard and identified us, and they were very mad. And they put us in the prisoner of war camp anyway. So, you know, growing up on a horse or in a tractor, and you're used to heavy equipment, and you're used to being under, you know, machinery and things like that. Prisoner of war, you know, they, you know, how do we get these young kids to snap? And so I can remember the very first thing they put me in, it was a coffin cocked at 45 degrees with wooden stakes, you know, you lay down, they close it, and the stakes are right there in your face. And I thought, you know, what would I do if my dad were yelling at me right now? I'd go to sleep. So, you know, 5 minutes from there, I'm snoring away, and they're kicking the casket, trying to get me over here. You're cheating. I'm sleeping. So that was kind of how it went. So, prisoner of war training went well. Water survival went great. Actually, this is a cute story. You're a single seat pilot, so they make you have this anxiety. And they loaded us all up on a Coast Guard cutter and going 30 miles, 30 knots. And one at a time, you'd be hooked onto your risers like you were on a parachute, and they'd kick you off. And you'd get drugged, and you'd have to disconnect. And then every half a mile, they'd drop a pilot off. And I knew this was happening, so I, in my flight suit, I put a Ziploc bag with that day's newspaper, fishing wire, you know, some worms and stuff like that, cap, you know, and they didn't catch any of that. So after they leave you all day, and they kicked us out about 7:38 in the morning, and they came and picked us up, each one of us, at about 4 o'clock that afternoon. I had like 4 fish on the stringer, and it was just a guy. They just go, who is this guy? But it was that Oklahoma creativity, ingenuity. So I go off to fly the F-15, which is an absolutely great experience. And about that time, you know, Tom Cruise made Top Gun, and then it was just really crazy on deployments. You had to watch out because it was a really crazy time back then. But I was a serious military member. And not unlike the training I got in the Boy Scouts, to be prepared. So every day I prepared to fight. And that was back in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, the Reagan years, the Bush years. It was rich to be in the military. There's more money than you could spend. Flying the brand new jets. I picked up four brand new F-15s from McDonnell Douglas in St. Louis. I'd fly a commercial flight in, 24-year-old boy. They'd give me the sign for it. I'd walk around, kick the tires, get in, light them up, take it off, and I thought, it just didn't get better. So lo and behold, we go to war. We don't know we're going to war. Saddam Hussein, you know, invades. And I was in the unit. I was very frustrated that I didn't get to be in Europe or Asia. But I was in Virginia at the time, and that was the swing unit. Wherever we went to war, that was the unit that went first. And at the time, I thought, you know, it's never going to happen. It's going to be a nuclear war. But sure enough, Saddam invades. We get brought in, and all of us are lined up. This is an interesting story, so I'm sure. They told us to take our flight suits down to our waist and tie them. And you walked in the first, and there's a whole bunch of people on all two sides of the line. The first person, you walked up, and on either side, they're putting X's down your arm. And so seven X's on each arm, and then you walk to the next station, you get the guys shoot me in the top X, and the next station, the second X, and all you get the message. And at the end, you know, they said, you know, this is what we're doing. We're taking off in about 6 hours. You guys go home, grab toothpaste, bar soap, and tell your children, spouses goodbye, and come back. And this was my second operational unit, and I was brand new to the squadron. I'd only been there 3 weeks and barely knew any of these guys. But I enjoyed a reputation from my previous unit, and so the squadron commander made me his alternate lead. So there were 24 of us who took off. I was number three. So in the Air Force, it's every odd number is a leader and every even number is a wingman. So we have taken off, first unit to leave the U.S., and we're over Newfoundland, and that commander, who I barely knew, developed a problem and spun off and landed in Newfoundland, and I'm realizing as I see him fly off, I'm like, I'm in charge. I'm 27. I don't know anybody's name, and I don't know where in the heck I'm going. I was going east. I knew that was probably the right direction to stay. So sure enough, we have a lot of encrypted radios and all sorts of silly stuff on our jets, but a voice came on and told me to go to a frequency, and I did, and they gave me a latitude and longitude, and I typed it in, and they said, fly to it. I was like, I can do that. So flew to that point. As I'm getting to that point, here comes a big KC-135. We all get gas. I get another point. We fly to that point, fly to that point, fly to that point, all the way across the Atlantic. It's dark. And then we get to the western boundary of Europe, and the voice comes on and says, we don't have overflight rights anywhere. Just don't fly over the land. Now, I'm a pretty creative boy. I've studied the map, and I realize, well, that leaves the Strait of Gibraltar. So we all line up, and we fly over the Strait of Gibraltar, and I'm thinking, well, but now it's just the Mediterranean. It's a little ocean. 6 hours later, we got to the end of the Mediterranean, and they told me to go south across Egypt and then back east across the Red Sea. And I thought, well, I know we're going to land in Saudi Arabia because the next country over is the bad people from Iran. I know we're not going to do that. And sure enough, all the way on the far side, the last destination was, as I got about literally 100 miles from the site, I could see this massive airbase. And that was my first exposure to Saudi Arabia. They are a little bit like OU fans, you know, or Texans. You pick your choice. No, they're, you know, it's got to be the biggest and the best, right? So this airbase, I was like, my goodness, it's 5 times bigger than any airbase I've ever seen. But I found it and landed. And there's nobody on the base. I mean, literally, everybody's scared to death. Saddam is in Kuwait. There's no defenses between us and Saddam, and everybody's hiding. And as I pull in, and I'm thinking, you know, okay, this is going to be awkward. I've been flying for 17 hours. I'd really like to stop and get out, stretch my legs. And a little squatty guy, right, in this traditional dress comes running out, and he points, and then he runs back to the hardened aircraft shelter. So I think, well, what a good boy from Osage County do. So I took my helmet bag, opened up my canopy, and shut down one engine, and I threw my helmet bag underneath the tire. I crawled out, helped my next wingman, who helped the next one, and the next one. We all got off, and we immediately got back in the air. Four of us, we flew defensive caps during the Desert Shield phase while we were planning the invasion. And I say all this to say, back to scouting. The professional pilots, the fighter pilots with whom I fought, with whom I trained, every single one of them, 100% of the squadron, had a scouting background. Over 80% of those men were Eagle Scouts. It was a remarkable group of people to be with. We had a common value, we had a common core, we were devoted to our community and our country, we were servant leaders, we knew what was going on. And when the moment of combat began, those men, I could trust with my life, and they could trust their life with me. I'll give you a quick anecdotal out of respect for time, but it goes back to the discipline that we train our young people in. And that discipline echoes throughout our lives. If we can instill it in these young people, then we're going to be okay. And I know that so many of us here have it. Very first mission of the Gulf War, 3 a.m. in the morning. There were four attack axes. I led one of them. 72 fighter jets in the southeast corner of Baghdad. I was the F-15 guy that was out front leading with my four ship. And bad guys showed up, and we thought we got to shoot them and kill them, but they ran away. It was very frustrating. And got over Baghdad, and they were there. I could see them, but I had to stay over the combat in the target area. And so all the guys with the bombs, F-16s, F-111s, Tornadoes, they all did their thing, and they left. So my three and four man, my helmet lead and his wingman, escort them out, and I wait, and I'm on target until it's over. The last guy off, and I follow. And the whole time, people were shooting at us. It was totally crazy. I wasn't relaxed, but I knew I was about 40 miles from the Saudi border when I got directed to go north and kill. That's what I get paid to do. I'm going to turn around. So I knew that the Navy, all due respect to the Navy guys, they were going to be inbound. So the Air Force was the first strike back. The Navy was coming in. They were 180 miles out. And I just wanted to get away from the Navy guys because I didn't want to be a target. But they told me to go north. And I thought, well, I need to help out my brothers in the Navy. So I went north and found this guy about 120 miles away. And I called him out. And I go, yep, that's him. You're clear to kill. So I am an F-15 single-seat fighter pilot going 1.6 Mach at 35,000 feet. When I push a button on a missile, I can shoot somebody at 75 miles. I am King Kong. He's at 1,000 feet, and he's going half my speed, and I'm not feeling very threatened. His missile engagement zone is maybe 6 miles, 7 miles. So I hearken back whenever I was a young boy. I think I was probably a tenderfoot, and Chief Master Sergeant took me hunting, and I was so excited to be out there with my 410. The dog goes on point. I look into the covey. I see the covey. I put the shotgun to my shoulder, and I shoot on the ground in the covey. I was so excited. I killed three or four birds. Chief Master Sergeant looks at me, takes my rifle, shotgun, sets it down. Bends me over a tree and beat the living dickens out of me. I thought, what is that all about? He goes, son, we don't shoot into the covey. Made a point. So I get ready, birds. I'm ready to shoot. I've been ordered to kill, cleared to kill and ordered to kill. And I'm about to push the button. I'm thinking, I'm shooting into the covey. I just can't do that. And then that was a delay. That I call that the pause. And that pause was fast. That was the closure was about 20 miles every 6 seconds. That's how fast we're going towards each other. But during that pause, I realized he's not a threat. And something's not right. And in my heart, I believed him to be a good guy. So by now, there's a lot of heightened anxiety in the air with the airborne commanders and things like that. And I'm ordered to begin to kill. And that's when I've decided I'm not going to kill this guy. I'm going to go intercept him. And so I told the airborne general, the one star, that no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to intercept him. I think he's a good guy. Now, my wingman, also from Alabama, also an Eagle Scout, was talking to me in my mic, and from back mic, and going, what are you doing? Trust me. If he comes up, kill him, but I think he's good. So I ran the intercept. Sure enough, he was a good guy. and brought him back. It was a Saudi tornado. It was in my strike package. Came off the target. Instead of going south, went north fast and low. Realized the end is at the top of my compass. It should be at the bottom of my compass. So he turned around, came back. And he was so scared, he just got on the deck and he flew. And so the discipline that I give, the large part, scouting, I didn't kill the guy. I brought him back. Landed at the same air base with him. He was a member of the royal family. He pops his cannon. He gives me the royal formal bow. He goes in his direction. I go in my direction. And by now, all sorts of chaos has rained back down on my squadron because all they know is that there's a rogue pilot disobeying everybody and not doing what they're supposed to do. So I get arrested when I get on my jet. I think, wow, I'm just doing the right thing, really. And then they didn't care. But within about 15 minutes, I got awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. And from then on, I was totally like Teflon. I could do anything I wanted to. Got out my straw hat, grew out my mustache. It was great. So, and I tell you that story because not to bring glory to the Air Force or me, but it's just, I'm one of you. I'm one of these young people. Nothing special about us. We are just the salt and the soil of the United States. And what we are doing for these young people is we are making a difference. We are touching lives. We have been touched. Everyone in this room can look back to a teacher, a Boy Scout leader, a religious leader that made a difference in our life. All scouting is an organization making a difference in the lives of young people. That's why we're here. That's why we love scouting. And that's why we are and continue to be the greatest nation in this world. Thank you.